we should get going. Because we've got a lot we want to cover. First day, of course, you know, torture you, get all through the content, make you memorize everything. I'm joking. Okay, so some of you are maybe in Monday's section, right? Monday's lab. Are we meeting next week? No? Okay, great. Okay, so we know. Are we meeting this Wednesday coming up? No. All right, great. So, yes, definitely look at your blackboard and see what days you're meeting. Somebody came to the lab yesterday wondering where the lab was and how come it wasn't open. But anyways, all right. So we got to check everything out. I just want to make sure that we get that up front. I'm recording everything on Echo 360 as well as a podcast. And then I'll upload it to our webpage that we have for the class, all right? So it's not an automatic up onto Canvas, because sometimes the Canvas doesn't collect the file and it takes some time for it to upload. So this way I can actually do it a lot quicker by uploading it myself and putting it on personal capture. But with that said too, sometimes things don't work, like the batteries run out and this headphone. So I also have a podcast, so that'll be up there as well. So that's for you, but don't rely on it because it might not always work, right? Technology has some problems. So a little bit about me so you know who this crazy instructor is for you for the next semester here. So I'm Robin Cooper. I've been here going on 22 years coming up after this semester and teaching animal physiology almost every year. Sometimes I got off a class called 5 or 155 or 152 or whatever that is with 350 students that see a class. This is much more interactive because it's a smaller class, but also because we divided up the 350 into two different sections, basically two different groups. So we have a Monday, Wednesday, Friday group that Jeff Osborne teaches, and then a Tuesday, Thursday group, because it was too much of a bottleneck for students to get it all in just on one of those times. So that's really helpful. And then this class is not so packed as it used to be with everybody right next to each other. So that's really nice, so you can spread out. But with that said, too, we want to work in groups in the class. So we're going to break up into groups throughout the semester a little bit as well, and we'll kind of mix people up and have different ways that we'll do that to make it more interactive, okay? We're not in... I'll go through the syllabus a little bit and tell you some more interactive things that we'll be having. So I've been here going on 22 years after the semester. In animal physiology, we've gone through multiple textbooks over the years, and some of them are good, some of them are bad, but they've all increased their prices quite a bit, and it's really expensive to buy these books. So what we're trying to do is to not make a book required for the class, but if you have an older edition you want to buy, that's fine. If you have a new edition you want to buy or some animal physiology textbook, you can. That's fine, too. But I'll pretty much test out of what we're covering in class, all right, in the PowerPoints. But sometimes the content, extra reading, is really helpful. If you go online, you can buy some Amazon.com real cheap textbooks of previous versions that I've listed on the webpage, and it won't cost you that much money, and so you don't have to be out a lot if you want something to read. But an action potential of a neuron is no different than it's been taught probably 15, 20 years ago than it is now, right? And it doesn't matter if you want to read it in another language. We had students read books that were written in Chinese that were translated over, and that's fine too, because an action potential is taught the same way. It doesn't matter in China, Switzerland, Australia, or here, right? It's the same way that it works. So that basic content, you can learn in pretty much any textbook, right? So we're going to cover a lot of the basic contents. Remember, this is a survey course, animal physiology, to understand physiology. And we cover a lot of different components. It's not just a neurophysiology course or a muscle physiology course or a GI course. We have to really cover all the systems. But beyond that, we have to cover it in a comparative aspect, right? So that makes it a little bit more of a challenge. So what can we do? We can only take snips from different parts or in different systems and kind of encourage you and excite you about studying physiology and why we want to study physiology. All right, so hopefully this will be a fun class. It is a little bit of a challenge because there's a lot of content to cover as well. But most of the challenge, I think, really comes from this course being a dual course. And it's a dual course because it's a GCCR requirement, a writing requirement. So students that take this class, it's really two classes in one. You don't have to take it, the word 204 or whatever that number is, for the writing requirement, right? This takes care of both, the writing requirement plus animal physiology. But with that said, that means what? Double whammy for the same number of hours. It saves you some money in the long run, but it's a lot of work. So it's more work than probably your cell biology or your genetics or ecology, the other core courses in biology, because it's two courses in one. So what you have to do is kind of rub your temples and get ready for the headache, all right, of writing, a lot of writing. But think about it. You're saving money and you're saving time in this course by getting two things done at once. But with that said, there's a lot of writing, okay? Keep thinking. A lot of writing. You know, get some cramp cream or whatever you do for your hands or typing. Okay, so I want to go over a little bit what we're covering, and I don't know why that one's not showing there. It should show over there too. So with that said, of being here that many years, I've gone through physiology a number of times. So what's my role up here? Not to just lecture, spill out the same information, and watch your heads, you know, fall out or hit the chair and get a coma or something, but to try to cover the main points that are difficult in the content, right? To try to emphasize some points and maybe teach it in different ways, and the textbook goes over it and reinforce some of the main concepts. So when you walk out of here in May, you can say, I understand general physiology. That's my goal, for you to understand general physiology. Okay? And with that, I will make sure to hit some of those harder points that we have in the content in this class, so it won't be so frustrating for you. Let me cut these lights off for you. Don't fall asleep, Julie. Okay. All right. So what else? If some of you are neuroscience majors, maybe? No? Yes? And that you know I'm your DUS for neuroscience, so if you have some questions on neuroscience, but also advise biology. But neuroscience is within the biology department, so if you have any questions there too. If you're in a neuroscience program, you don't have to take the word 204 for your writing requirement. This will cover that as well. All right, so some people were confused about that, trying to take both courses. So what do we do here? A little bit of background. Undergraduate years, I grew up in West Texas, and I was a pre-vet when I started off, actually, to college, and realized, hey, this is kind of cool. You know, worked with a veterinarian. Then went on to college at Texas Tech, you know, the Red Raiders, in case you're into that. And started off in animal sciences, had some interesting questions, and one of my faculty members said, well, maybe go over to biology and they'll answer more details. I had enough with judging cattle and, you know, pinching the sheep and judging sheep and all that going up through high school. And so I wanted to get into something else. So biology was really cool. Worked with some people in a lab. That was really interesting. Then I wanted to understand a little bit more. Went over and transferred over to the chemistry department and really enjoyed working in a chemistry lab there as undergraduate research. And it was actually the first time this guy had an undergraduate really working in the lab. So it was kind of an interesting case. But then from there, I realized, you know, took a lot of courses, a lot of nice field courses in biology. If you get a chance to, you know, take those, I recommend you to get out in the field and get some real biology, you know, integrate out there. And then my advisor said, you just need one more course and you could have your double major, biology and chemistry. And so I took it. I shouldn't have. It was genetics. I still have struggled with genetics. Probably a lot of you struggled well, too. But back then, they were just discovering DNA, so, you know, I had to understand AT and all that stuff. But it was okay. I got through it. And then went on to graduate school in physiology. I really enjoyed physiology. And at that time, they were just starting neuroscience programs across the country and got involved in a neuroscience lab and then really enjoyed that and continued to work in neuroscience. And a postdoc in Switzerland for 4 years. Then after that, another 4 years of postdoc in Toronto, Canada. Then came here 21 and a half years ago. So that's kind of my life story. And then teaching physiology. What we do in the lab, pretty much, we work on Drosophila systems and crustacean systems, as well as collaborate with the person over in the rehab sciences on muscle physiology. And so there's a really good group on campus, and this kind of makes a segue into other things that you can get involved in. There's a center of muscle biology here, and people from the heart surgeon, heart transplant surgeon, to people in athletic training, to people working with muscle and culture dishes. There's a whole group here. It's, I think, 14 different departments. People actually get together. And every Thursday, around 11 to 12, in case you're just dying for more lecture, there's actually a journal club with the Muscle Center Muscle Biology. But also, they take a lot of students into their labs, and undergraduate research. And they're very into undergraduate research. So you can look up Center Muscle Biology at UK and get involved if you want to. Other things to get involved in, there is a Biology Honor Society. Anybody in Tri Beta here? Tri Beta? Anybody heard of Tri Beta? Okay, good. So there is a Biology Honor Society. I started that about, oh God, I don't know, maybe 13 years ago or so. And last year, we passed it on to Clara O'Quinn and Seth Jones. So they're actually running that. And that's a Biology Honors group. Tri Beta is a national group, and we have a chapter here. So I don't know what they're going to be doing this year, but if you have some representatives here, officers, that maybe you want to spend some time and talk about it. Did y'all have a meeting yet? No?
We had a couple meetings last semester.
Okay. Do you have plans for this year?
I'm not sure yet. I think a once-a-month meeting. I know last semester we got involved in the science fairs around Lexington.
Okay.
And judging those.
Fantastic. So what she just mentioned was that last year they had their last meeting. They'll probably be having some more meetings. Maybe you can tell the class when you're having your next meeting. And so, whenever it happens.
I'm not sure exactly when it is on the calendar. But
right. And then getting involved in science fairs, that gives you something else to get out there and actually do. Unfortunately, two science fairs are next Thursday at the same time. Maybe we could just go all over. No. Okay. So that's a problem for next Thursday. But I'll let you know about other science fairs that you might want to participate at. A lot of the school science fairs are a problem for college students because they're during the day. But the county science fair is on a Saturday. It's really an awesome event to get involved and build your resume a little bit. But just to experience what these students are doing and help them, encourage them to continue asking questions and get involved in science and engineering topics. And to, you know, encourage them, right? To keep them going. Just like I'm going to try to encourage you to keep studying, right? And so it's the same thing. We can pass that on down the line. And some of the kids need some extra coaching. So that's really helpful. All right. And then other aspects to get involved in across campus. There are a number of things to, you know, might be in sororities or fraternities, but also other aspects. We have a Kentucky Paleontological Society here. Paleontology, you know, study of fossils in the ground. They meet once a month here, and they actually take field trips on a Saturday after their meeting on a Friday night, usually. The next day is a Saturday, and they go all over the state of Kentucky, and there's some really good people involved in the Kentucky Paleontological Society, and they let you collect fossils or geodes, and you know, you learn a little bit more about our ancient history. And there's actually paleophysiology to try to understand some of these fossilized animals and how they functioned as well, so you might think of that. There's also caving groups here on campus. Anybody a caver? Anybody ever go into a cave? Mammoth cave, right? Anybody ever go over to a wild cave that's not up with lights?
Yeah, I don't do that anymore.
Okay. So there is a caving group here, the Bluegrass Grotto, and they meet once a month as well. And they like to take people out, and they actually do a lot of outreaching activities, take Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts out to the Great Saltpeter Cave that's down by Somerset kind of area. Well, no, it's on the other side of the road, but down that direction. And then there's caves all over by Somerset, in case you ever want to go caving sometime. We might have a cave trip. We used to work with Cave Crayfish, and they were quite interesting as well. But Kentucky is known for the cave systems, right? So it's really interesting to maybe get involved in some of those activities. So what I'm trying to say is that there's a lot of different things that you can get involved in, and that's really the advantage of college in the university setting. There are so many different things to do and get exposure to that you might not have done normally in high school, right? And so you don't want to saturate yourself with those things, but maybe embrace getting out of the box a little bit and getting going somewhere. I bring that up because a lot of you are pre-med and pre-allied health in here, and a lot of it is just study, right? And you want to make good grades, and you want to do well on your MCAT score, and then you don't have time to do other things. But sometimes taking that break is really good. We just had a student last year. She worked in the lab, and she was in the class before. And she, you know, she actually finished undergraduate in 3 years, straight A's, all that good stuff, good MCAT scores, and she got accepted to a med school, and a good med school. But she realized that she was missing out on so much of life. So she asked the med school if she would take a year deferral, and they gave it to her because she is a good student and everything. And then she could start later. And what did she do? She went over to the far western side of China in rural villages and taught for a year because she realized that she hadn't experienced life yet. And she was going to go on through med school, another 4 years, and the residency, and never really get out and do things, right? And then you start your rat race of paying your bills, and you never can get out of that little rat race. So, you know, think about those things. Here's somebody that's very bright that, you know, succeeded with that, but then also wanted to get some exposure to the world. So those are things to think about as well. And I just encourage you to maybe think about studying abroad sometimes, or maybe getting a summer, you know, internship somewhere. A lot of the summer internships are right online right now, and their deadlines are coming up towards the end of January, beginning of February. What do I mean by these internships? Marine Biological Laboratory, called MBL. It's over by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. If you ever heard of UEs, or the submarine that goes down in all over the world and explores things, our best Marine Biology Institute is actually MBL, Marine Biological Laboratory. They have courses every summer, some just in neurobiology, some in genetics, some in Drosophila genetics, and then other courses as well, like in bioinformatics, or ecology courses. And usually, like MBL, there's marine biology courses all over in Savannah, Georgia, Carolinas, Friday Harbor up in Washington State. And you can apply to those programs. Usually, when you apply to the class and you get in the class, these are competitive classes to get into, worldwide competition, okay? But you've got to put your best foot forward and write a good resume for it and purpose statement why you want to take it. But usually, when you get accepted to some of those courses, they pay your stipend while you're there. You just have to get there, okay? So that's not so bad. And some of these are, if you ever heard of REUs, NSF for REUs, Research Experience for Undergraduates. A lot of those applications are coming online now as well. So type in, you know, your Google search, NSF REUs. And they then take in so many students, like maybe 15 or 20 students for the summer, and then you work, and they pay you money while you're there. It pays for your living expenses. You just have to get there, basically. And there's REUs all over. Some are just field ecology. Some are working in labs. Some are ornithology, studying birds, or herpetology. So, get out and get exposure. Sometimes those courses, like I mentioned at Marine Biology Labs, if you search ahead of time and you get approval through UK, you can get credit for that course. You'll count that course for your degree, right? So that's pretty good, but they have to look at the syllabus and get all that approved before you go to the class, right? So maybe do your applications, find out if you get accepted, then, you know, sign up for it. We did have a student just the other day that was looking for courses overseas to get some study abroad experience. She found three neuroscience classes in Copenhagen, Denmark, right? Three neuroscience classes, all taught in English, undergraduate courses. Plus, she actually wrote to a faculty member there and got involved in a research lab. So now she can get research credit, plus her three neuroscience courses, and she's not going to lose any time for graduation. And she's going to get to stay in Copenhagen, Denmark for a semester. Isn't that great? But it's probably going to, you know, cost a little bit, but, you know, you can always find some sofa to sleep on somewhere, probably, and cheaper places to go. There's youth hostels all over as well. So hopefully that's a little pep talk. Is that good? Get you going? Think about it tonight. Type in NSF, REUs, and all that good stuff. So, you know, I think those are great experiences to get out and experience things. Now down to the nitty-gritties. I know. The class. All right. So we do have a webpage, and this is your webpage, right? And you can find it by just searching Cooper, UKY. Who knows what you'll find. But anyways, this is your web page, and all your main content for lab, as I'll go over, is on Canvas. But on your web page, we have some, what do we have here? Wow, we have some tests, old tests. Those are good to think about and going over there. And I will put a test bank on Canvas that has, I don't know, 200 or something pages of test questions over 10 years from different instructors, too. So some of that content won't be too pertinent to what we're covering in here, because some of the teachers in the past, like Brent Palmer, he's retired, but he was very heavy into reproductive endocrinology. So some of those questions are really detailed because he covered that in his lectures, but I wouldn't go into that same kind of detail. And then, like, there's some questions about neurophysiology that he wouldn't cover, but, of course, we love to neurophysiology, so we put those in. Okay, so I'll put that up on Canvas, but I would suggest start to look over the test bank, because that kind of helps you mentally to think of the types of questions that we might have. Okay, so you know what sections you're in. All the sections except for section one are pretty full. I mean, we've got a packed 7 sections of animal physiology this semester. Sometimes we've only had 4, but there's some kind of bolus of student population coming through, so we have 7 sections of animal physiology this semester. So that's a lot of maintenance in the lab, too. So I'm dealing with you 1 through 4 sections in Jeff Osborne, 5, 6, and 7. And so his is on Tuesday, Thursday, and we're on... I mean, his is on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and we're on Tuesday, Thursday. With that said, you really can't switch sections and things like that because the content might be different. The format is different between our lectures, too, and what we might cover on exams. So Dr. Danley, she's been helping to maintain these labs for the last number of years, so she really knows the lab content. And like I said, the GCR requirements are pretty strict in this class in the sense of, we'll go through a little bit of that, but that takes a lot of work, and so she has a lot of work covering your lab reports and everything else. We have some really good TAs. Jason Collette, actually Dr. Jason Collette, he finished his PhD here a number of years back. He went to Indianapolis for a postdoc, and his wife is a medical student. She got a residency over here at UK Medical School, so they moved back here, so he's teaching while she's here for this year, and then he'll probably go back up to Indianapolis to continue doing research. But he knows physiology really well. He's been a TA for this course for a number of years. He's just been out of it for about 5 years, but he'll come right back jumping in. Anadria, she was an undergraduate student here. She helps maintain the labs. You'll see her in and out. Kristen LaRue, I don't know that well, but she's a new student, a graduate student that's in the department, so she'll be teaching. Victoria, she's been teaching or TAing this class, I think, for 3 semesters, so that's really good. And Jeffrey Chaffant, he's been a TA for the course before, too. And Bookie, she's been a TA last semester in the course as well, and she's a graduate student in the department. So their email contacts are there, and you'll figure out how the labs work when you get to the labs. So just to kind of go over a few things, we have a course outline here. You can download. I updated this last night to try to match the other group, Jeff Osborne's group, of grading and the lab grades and all that kind of stuff. So I just updated it again last night in case you downloaded it earlier, and I put a new version in on Canvas. So in case you did that, you might want to go and recheck that out. Okay, lecture schedule. It's right here, as you can see. A little bit small font, I know, in the back of the room. Sorry about that. But what we're going to do here is after every class, or probably even before the classes, I will try to put up the PowerPoints, but I'll be putting a hot link to the podcast in Echo 360 right here. Now, Echo 360 files get kind of large. Some of those are 300 or 400 megabyte files, so you don't want to just click on it and try to view it on your screen right there. You want to download it to your computer. It'll be a lot easier for you in the long run, is download it, build a folder, you know, put your echoes in there, and usually I do it by date. I put a date on there, like, you know, 01/11/2018, and you'll be able to follow that through. And the podcast will be smaller in case you just want to cruise through there and find some mistake I made and question you on a test question or whatever you want to do, that's fine. And that's really good. In the case you like some alpha wave music, there you go. You got some alpha wave music. And then some other great music to help reduce stress. All right? So you can go through those. Now, I just want to bring up some points here really quick while we can mention this. Down here in yellow, these exams, the first exam, you got two main lecture exams, and then we have a final exam. So 3 exams. All right? Sometimes we used to make 4 exams. Gives you a little buffer, but it takes a lot of time away from lecture 2. But what we're going to do this year is have 2 lecture exams and a final exam. And the final exam is worth more points. We'll go through that. But that first lecture exam is not going to be in your lecture. So you don't have to be stressed out with time. We have students always like, I need more time. I didn't have enough time. So what we're going to do is have 4 different exams, and we're going to take them in the lab. Because that week, there's no lab. So what we're going to do is you have a 3-hour lab. You can probably finish in 2 hours, but we'll be there for the 3 hours if you need to. All right, so that first week, when you see that there's no lab on your that week on your Canvas for Dr. Danley's labs, but we're going to have, what are we going to have that week? Exams in the lab, but it gives you a lot more time, right? It reduces that stress, making sure that you don't have that excuse. I didn't have enough time. I didn't write it all out. But no, now you have enough time. And there'll be four different exams. We'll definitely look at the differences. There's going to be different questions, multiple choice questions, and open response questions, okay? Because you have the time for that. So some short answers, open response questions. And I'll try to get those graded in time within 1 week. And we come back, and that next week, for some reason, there's no lab. I think it has to do with the animals that are coming in. We will then go over that exam, all of the four exams, in each of those four sections, and then make sure that everybody understands what we were looking for in that content. Okay, so it gives you a lot more time for interaction, discussion, understanding the content, and then we'll have some lab demos and lab stuff that is not normally scheduled for the lab or you're not graded on, but actually a good learning experience. Okay, so we understand that first exam is open response, all that good stuff, and you can fill in some of the questions, and we'll go through that as we go along. Then you have spring break, and then there's another time where there's no lab scheduled. All right, let me just scroll on down. But we're going to go to the lab, because I hate wasting lab time, and we're going to do some demos and have some fun activity, but also that lab time is going to be what? Exam review time, because the following week, then we have an exam in lecture, all right? So, yeah, the following week, there's a exam will be in here, okay? But then we'll use that week before in lab to do some fun lab activities and review for the exam. So it won't take lecture time. We'll have a lot of time in the lab to answer any of your questions, all right? So there's no stress to try to get it all in. Plus, there's only 25 or 26 students in a lab. It's a lot easier to get you out of your box and to chit-chat about something that you might be confused on, all right? So that's the idea. It gives you a lot of opportunities. Take advantage of these opportunities that you have because we haven't done that before, but I think this is going to give you a lot more time to integrate, think, discuss. That's part of the learning. All right. And then we have some more great music, and then we have a final exam. All right. So that's that business. Okay, so let's jump on over to your Canvas real quick. Canvas. Everybody gets on Canvas, I hope. Right? Question.
Is the exam that we take in the lecture going to be formatted differently than when we take in lab?
Yes. Because we have less time, it'd be more multiple choice, probably shorter, short answer questions, not such long essay questions that you'll have hand cramps. You just have to, go C's all the way down kind of thing. No, I'm joking. Okay. All right. You have to get used to the sarcasm. All right. So in here, you go to your Canvas. It's really quite a bit in there, and I really encourage you to take some time ahead of time to look at this. The assignments right here, you will see this. Your lab TA will go over this as well. You have lab quizzes. You get graded on these, right? And they're online, and they're already open, right? So you look at the dates, click on them, and it'll actually tell you when it's due. The problem we've had in the past years with Canvas, like last semester and the year before, is that you wait until 11:58, right, to submit your... This is actually open for 5 days, so you have time to go in there and do it. But once you hit submit, it's done, right? But if you wait until 11:58 and it's due at midnight, what happens? The way Canvas works is it goes to some other site and then bounces back to this site. Now, I know the speed of electrons are really fast, and, maybe a plane flew through the satellite connection or something. But sometimes that gets a little slow, and it takes a minute or two, sometimes 5 minutes. And then what happens at midnight? You turn into the pumpkin, right? It closes out, and then you can't get your quiz submitted. The same with Turnitin. The lab reports that you'll be writing are going through Turnitin site. That checks for plagiarism and things, and I'll cover a little bit about that in a minute. But that takes some time for that system to work. So if you hit it at 11:55 and it's going through its system to check things, and then it goes back to the Canvas and says submitted late and it's closed and you can't submit, it's a real issue, right? So just think in your mind, 12 o'clock is really 11 o'clock. And you're going to get everything submitted an hour ahead, right, at least. So that's the way to think about this. It avoids a lot of problems. So that's really good to think about. Your lab quizzes are basically to look through your lab protocols ahead of time. So Don't just get, you can open lab quiz, but this is really to help you to understand the lab that you're going to work on that week. So if you go to lab one worksheet, if it'll open up, it basically tells you what the lab's kind of doing that week. You'll see you have a lab one, a worksheet, and a document to look through. This is what you're going to be filling out during that lab time as well, but you want to look at it ahead of time. There's also PowerPoints for that lab that will appear in, let's see, I think that's under files. Lab content, it's posted, it's open, it's online. I'll put some extra lecture content in there, but everything I do pretty much is going to be on the class webpage. But if you look under lab content, you look under lab one, there's crayfish metabolism. So your first lab is on crayfish metabolism. So get familiar with this Canvas website. There's actually a lot there, right? And you're going to get kind of confused if you're waiting the night before to try to figure out your lab and the lab quiz and all that. So I would spend the weekend a bit cruising through it, getting familiar with it, and trying to download some of these, maybe to put it on your personal computer and start looking through there, and then you can look at the quiz and things like that, all right? That way it reduces stress. Stress is good sometimes if you want to raise your glucose levels and stuff, but not all the time, not right before assignments. Okay, so that helps with that. What was I going to do next? Oh, yeah. There was something fun. Oh yeah, for lab assignments, too. This turn it in is a nightmare, but for some students. But what you can actually do is turn it, how many you're used to turn it in? Yeah? Okay. You know what it does? Right? Okay, everybody? In case you don't know what it does, it checks your writing assignment against everybody else's writing assignment that has been used, plus web pages, plus another site that a lot of people like to copy and paste called Wikipedia. And when you do that, it actually flags it and says, oh, flagged. And then you get this big red thing on the Turnitin site, and it shows every word that was copied directly. Now, a lot of the things might be showing the same content when it's like the references. If you do use some other content, you reference it, right? You use a citation. You put where it came from. You even use the web link. And you could even write, I copied this from this site. You know, it's really good. It explains this little detail. But then you write underneath it, from my understanding, this is what this really means, putting it in your own words. Now, some people were really quite good about trying to do this. So they actually copied a student's report from the year before. But they cited it. So that was kind of nice. They said, I've taken this from, you know, Joe Smith's report and copied his introduction. Well, that was nice, he cited it, but what, you know, also not his own work then, right? So you don't want to do that. And we've had people in the past that are, you know, it's not a good thing to do. So some people put their lab reports up online. There's some sites where you can dump your lab reports or whatever you want for others to use, and it goes onto this online site. Well, what happens is that is also checked by Turnitin. And then it comes down, and we found one semester, I think three semesters back, where like four students had the same report from a student that was a year before them. And it was all from their copying from the site. What happens with Turnitin, if there's plagiarism, which is not good, is that you get maybe a warning. It depends on how bad it is. But then Melody Danley then has a meeting with me and the chair, and then we go over your plagiarism report, and then we have to file it with the university. And then where does that go? On your record. Not a good thing to have on your record, okay? So you don't want to have these on your record. It's really hard to get it removed. Plus, it just takes another meeting time and scheduling and all that, and a lot of stress. So try not to do that. Lab partners, you know, you're working together for your collecting your data, but what happens to your assignments, your writing assignments? They're individual, right? Because why? And I know this is an issue with this class, is this GCCR requirement. But the problem is then you have to be individually evaluated for the GCCR, right? If you do it as a group all the time, it doesn't, it's not you, it's not your work. So this is the problem with this GCCR requirement is that we have to have individuals work, and that gets assessed sometimes randomly, right? They're going to use this course for an assessment, and they're going to randomly pick, you know, files that were turned in and look at how was it graded? Was it graded well? Is this, you know, meeting the standards? And this is something university-wide. So, you know, do your good work on this and try not to copy from your partner. Now, some people, my own son went through college, and he told me all those little tricks. You know, he would reword it, right, and change the flow a little bit. Guess what? Turnitin catches some of that as well. So you want to be really careful. You know, like every sentence was reworded on one person's report, but it was the same content, same thing, but they just kind of reworded the sentence. Well, Turnitin catches that. So it doesn't show your own understanding of the content, right? It just shows that you can reword somebody else's content. Okay, so some fun things too. Let's go through some interesting stuff to get us worked up a little bit here. I don't know, that one doesn't work there. I have to switch over to this one. This is kind of fun, and we'll talk about it in a minute, but hopefully it'll get you going, get the blood moving.
Since she was a schoolgirl. Now she's 28 and one of the best rock climbers in the world. This time she's in Africa, getting some local advice for a new climb.
I'm going to move ahead a little bit. Class, I want you to think about physiology right here too.
When she was 14, and then graduated to the French and Italian Alps. This rocky plateau was once the kingdom of the Tenen Pygmies. They scratched a precarious existence amongst the crags and crevasses. They chose this perilous high life to escape their aggressive and bigger neighbors. But by the 12th century, even the pygmies had abandoned this barren rockscape.
Just a little bit longer.
Men included. She's won speed climbing contests all over Europe. And now the lure of a new challenge in West Africa, and a small inducement from a filmmaker, has brought you to this rock face on the Bandiagara Cliffs. Up yet, the last pitch to the summit is the most dangerous stretch of all. Back at ground level, the celebration party has already started.
Okay, so...
What's a heck of a celebration?
Celebration. So what do you think about that, physiology-wise? What's going on?
That's a lot of endurance. Like, I guess your muscles need to preserve their energy so that, like, as you get to the top, you can still continue on.
Right. So a lot of energy in her muscles and endurance. Do you think there's some psychology before she gets going on this? Right? I think she has some screws loose. But anyway, she definitely had to psych herself up for this, right? And the physiology, like you just mentioned, you know, she had the energy stores. What do you think the energy stores that she had to build up for this were? Do you think she had a high fat diet before? Do you think she had a high protein diet before this? Or do you think she had a high carbohydrate diet before this? Carbohydrate diet. So if you're into running or, you know, like marathons, usually they'll go ahead and eat a big old pasta meal the night before, spaghetti, right? And storage that glycogen, glucose, and then break that glycogen down during the race so they don't hit what basically is the wall. If she got tired up there, you know, on that wall, what do you think would happen to her if her muscles started shaking and gave out? Wouldn't be very good, you know. I guess the lions would have a meal down below or something. But so, you know, you think about the physiology here, there's a lot to this kind of endurance training, right? And even for you, if you were going to take a large exam, you know, like those MCATs for 8 hours the next day, what kind of meal would you want to have the night before? You want to store up that glucose. Your brain takes a lot of energy. And we'll talk more about that. So this is a segue into this first, this wasn't just random, this is a segue into this first part of the content about energy metabolism, all right? And you think about her muscles that were being used, but also her brain for, you know, concentration, took a lot of energy. And then that's metabolism, right, at a cell level. So the cell level is really important to understand. So when you took cell biology, or if you're going to take cell biology, understanding how that cell works really drives your whole body. Let's think of another example about this to try to get you to realize that we do need to pay attention to cell biology in the physiology course. So let's say you were out running, you realized, oh my gosh, I thought class started at 10, but it's 9:30, and you didn't want to miss class, so you're running into here, you know, from the parking lot or wherever it was, and then you come in, and then you sit down. Why are you breathing at a higher rate when you're not utilizing that energy? Right? You ran in here, you sat down, you're not utilizing a lot of energy now, right? But why are you continually breathing at a higher rate?
Maybe from the stress of the rest of class.
Yeah, the stress, but what do we mean by that stress? So that's really good. Stress is psychological, but what do we mean by that? What, anybody else help me out? Yeah. So if you're moving your muscles, you know, running, what are you using? Energy, right? some of you that cell biology, I know, you purged over the holidays, right? And something happened to me during whatever.
Initially, if you're running really hard, you could be undergoing anaerobic respiration, and so your body's compensating for that by taking in a lot of oxygen.
Right. So the anaerobic respiration means no oxygen, for example. Maybe you're not having enough oxygen when you're utilizing that, and you built up maybe some byproducts like lactic acid, and now you're trying to use that up through the TCA electron transport chain. Remember those things? Oh, you purged it. It's all coming back. The nightmare's coming back. Okay. Just start shaking tonight at midnight. But we'll be talking about these factors at a cell level and then how that energy is being utilized and why you're still breathing at a higher rate. I don't want to give it away completely right now, but we'll do that when we get going a little bit more. Okay, so those are the kind of things to kind of pull this together in this chapter. Some other aspects I want you to think about, because what we're going to try to do in this class is actually have a very interactive, and you can bring your laptops, iPhones, whatever you want to do, iPads, and you can look up stuff as well or work as a group. That will help too. How many people have those iClicker things? Or I should say, how many people don't have an iClicker account or an iClicker itself? Does everybody have an iClicker account? What's an iClicker? So you might have the white thing, or do you have an account online that you can use? You have an online account. You don't need the physical clicker.
Is this one good?
That's turning point. That's like a other thing. So I meant where you go online. No? Okay. So you could redo those things. Sometimes what I don't like is that they make you, the students, buy into these things, you know, $14 for 6 months. But, of course, if you got it, like in August, when the 6 months in, then you have to buy it again for the next semester, and it's only like another month. So I don't know. Maybe we don't need to use iClickers, because I don't want people spending more money than they have to. It's already too expensive. But what we'll do is to put up some... I have another way to do this. It's actually kind of fun. I work with high school science teachers, and it's called Plickers. Not clickers, but Plickers. You hold up these little cards, and you get an answer as a group, and I can go around and take pictures of it, and actually get a response very quickly, and it doesn't cost you anything to pay for a service. Right? So I'll introduce you to those. And scratch-offs, little scratch-off things. You don't win money, but you win points. So we'll get some scratch-off, too, and you can work as a group on some of these things, too. So we're going to work in some groups as we go along in the semester. With that said, too, I don't want to... I'll try to tell you ahead of time, you know, which classes we're going to do these kind of things. You know, I'm very practical. And so we're going to have maybe some bad weather coming up next week, and it might even be icy or snowy, something like that. I don't want you to have to try to risk, if you're commuting in, to drive, to come to class, and get a car accident and all that kind of stuff, right? So on those days, you know, don't think that I'm going to try to torture you if you're not here or something like that with a, you know, clicker question or whatever it is. We'll definitely wait, and I'll try to give you a heads up, like, hey, on Tuesday we're going to do this, right? But on bad weather days, if you can't make it, you know, you're not going to lose points in that sense, because I'm going to try to record it all, but at least you'll have the PowerPoints if it does screw up recording. Question?
Was a suggestion. Uh-huh. I know in our biochem class we did, it's free through Echo 360 on Canvas. You can put questions up.
Oh, yeah, you could do that. Or these little quizzes like we have for the lab stuff. That's a good point, too.
And it's just like the turning point, like the clickers. So it's just online. You can do it on your phone.
We can try that, too. Yeah, so the iClicker, I think that's actually iClicker, but online through Canvas. So Canvas is connected with iClicker, but I think I can make it where it might be an open account.
Free.
Yeah, that's really good. I'll try to figure out that. So we'll work out something there for free stuff. All right, so what else are we covering? Oh, for content then, when you're thinking about things, what kind of sites are you going to rely on, right, and get information from? So... this is kind of fun to watch, just a little bit of this, and I'll kind of speed this up. Let's see if this will work. Oh, crap. Maybe I have to put it over here. I don't know. Let's see. I don't know if this is going to record. Basically, I want you to try to think about it. National Geographic did this really neat show. It was on a National Geographic site, and what they did... is they made this kind of nice little recording and put it up online, and they actually used it in their article, and they showed this nice little town in Italy, and it's very well done. Looks like it's a really good thing. And they're out on a spaghetti harvest off the trees. All right? Is there something wrong with that? Okay. So the point was, this was an April Fool's joke by National Geographic. Get it? April Fool's? Okay. But it really caused a lot of problems because some people believed it. Not a good thing, right? People didn't believe. Now you can see them harvesting the spaghetti. Why am I bringing this point up? Not just random information, but it's about where you get your resources from, right? When you get your resource, now Wikipedia has some really good sites, and they got really good information too. But if you look at the references, there's a reference click usually after statement, and you can go to the bottom of the page and find the original article, right? The original reference, and find out if they misstated it or not, right? Sometimes the wiki pages are crazy. Sometimes they're really good. And so you have to watch out where you get your sites from. Now, this one was really wild because of the spaghetti harvest, and it caused people a lot of grief, actually, and caused National Geographic a lot of grief. Then you might have remembered let me see if I can get this on the other site, maybe. I don't know if I can or not. Well, I'll just show you a little bit of this. It's kind of fun. So PBS had a show one time. See if I can make that full screen. It was on a PBS show where they showed these humans that were actually like half fish, right? Do you remember that? And that humans came from this, and they showed them swimming through the water, and that there's like Waterworld. Do you ever see Waterworld? It's kind of crazy movie. It's a generation gap here. But you know, people evolved like webbed feet and things like that. And National PBS had a show with that, and it was really kind of like, people were wondering, is this true? Because they made it look like they found this person in a fish market, it was half fish, half human, like a mermaid. And people were really wondering because they trusted PBS shows. But then they were making it as a joke, right? But they got a lot of slack by that because it confused children. And so it was, they have to make these disclaimers instead now. But this one's kind of neat. Look at this octopus walking on two legs. Pretty much. Now, this octopus is called a coconut. Oh, crap. It's called a coconut, and it died on me. It's called a coconut octopus, and it's something very unique. It can actually walk on 2 feet. Now, do you think this is real or fake? Real, fake? How many say it's fake? How many say it's real? Yes. And it is a Smithsonian Channel and National Geographic, but remember, National Geographic plays those April Fool jokes on you, right? So this is, they think, one of the most intelligent cephalopods, actually, because it actually carries a shelter with it, hides in that clam, and picks it up and carries it with it, and it actually carries it and then like hides like that until a crab comes around, and then it can jump out and grab it, right? But you could be confused sometimes, you know, animation, Star Wars, all that, you know, what's real, what's not. So it's a time period now that can be very confusing for information and knowing what's real, what's not. So you have to be kind of on your edge and really be inquisitive and ask questions. But also to see if there's backup information from other people that can concur with that or back it up. All right? So this is the point I want to try to make for you, not just this class, but life in general. And some of you might think that's kind of silly, but actually it's not, because we have people that still do not believe like CO2 is rising, right, in the atmosphere. Right? And temperature. And so you can go to the NOAA site, right? You can go to the NOAA site and you can type in NOAA and CO2, and you can map that for what? The last how many years? 5 years? 10 years? How long can you map the CO2 rise in the atmosphere? Do you think? 100 years? 200 years? 200? Longer? Anybody? Let's go for 200. Let's go for 500. Let's go for 1,000. Right? And temperature change. How long can you, do you think you can measure atmospheric temperature changes in some areas in the world? How deep can you core the ice core samples? And there are some trees that actually have records of 5,000 years. All right? 5,000 years. And people have reproduced this multiple times and have done this. Ice core samples, where they can get ice core and look at CO2 levels for many hundreds of years. Not just 200, but much longer. and that data is reproduced by multiple people throughout the world. So sometimes when you hear somebody say, I don't believe in CO2 rising, I don't believe in temperature rising, well, where does those beliefs come from? Is it backed up with evidence? All right? The same thing in your physiology. Biology. Where is the evidence? Always ask yourself, where is the evidence? So my barber that's over at Zandell Barber, I don't know if any of you guys go over there, but if you do, you probably get buzzed like mine. Old-fashioned barbers. And there's this guy there that had this nice big old dent in his head. And he always liked talking about fishing stories. And he's relatively old. And that, you know, he was talking about things. And I said, so what, you know, what happened there? Were you out fishing? You fell in the rocks and things like that? And he said, no. I was part of this study. And I said, what study? And he said, oh, part of the Appalachian Cincinnati study. I said, what do you mean? He said, oh, those was the ringworm study. I said, you don't mean the study where they x-rayed you. And he said, yeah, how'd you know about that? Well, when I was a graduate student, I was working with radioisotopes, and we had to take an education course in working with radioisotopes. All right? And in that course, I remember this one case was when people, like, this is what I'm telling you about, what you might accept today will be a joke later on. So back in the day, it was accepted. There was a whole group in eastern Kentucky and West Virginia that had ringworm. You know, a little ringworm. It makes a little round thing on your skin, right? And so what did they do with these kids? They shaved their heads off, like mine. I don't have ringworm. But what they also did to kill the ringworm out, they x-rayed them. They gave them x-ray until the skin turned a little red. 99.9% of all those children had brain cancer and died. Standard treatment, standard medical treatment. Is that good? Bad? You look back at it, and you realize, what the hell is wrong with those people? Right? And, you know, and so they actually took those kids and they studied them. He was one of the study cases. And I said, that's amazing. He said, yeah, all my friends died. They had it. You know, and here's his whole class that basically died out. Because what? They believed in the medical profession. The medical profession at the time. Right? So this is the point I want to make. What might be accepted today will be a joke later on. Or you'll look back and say, oh, crazy stuff. I mean, we can talk about everything in here. For example, women used to douche themselves, wash out their, you know, private parts, right? That was a big thing. Happened all the time to keep themselves clean. What did that do? Caused a lot of UTIs. Tremendous number of UTIs. Why? Why do you think that caused a lot of UTIs? Well, not so much that. So the idea was maybe washing it out and getting it stuck, but it was another factor.
Disrupts the pH balance.
Disrupts the pH balance, and it knocked out the indigenous bacteria that was there, the good bacteria. And then they realized women shouldn't be doing this anymore, and then the UTI rate dropped tremendously. But everybody was told to do it, right? So here you believe you're a healthcare professional to do this. The other thing, when I was in college, I had a student, well, a colleague that was in my class, and she nearly died. And she had dropped out of college, and she got so sick, she lost some toes and some fingers as well from this. And back in the time, you know, more about women's health and things, but they used to use tampons, right? Tampons, you put it up, and you keep your, you know, bleeding localized, right? And you take that out. The problem is, if they left the tampon on in too long, and you might forget that it's there for a while, right? Anybody ever hear of a problem with that?
Yes.
Toxic shock syndrome. And a bacteria grows, streptococci, basically, and then you get septicemia, and then when you have septicemia, bacteria in your blood, you're in a life-threatening condition. And people died from that. Died from that. Toxic shock syndrome. Now, you know, people are aware of these things. But what again? At the time, completely acceptable. What am I trying to tell you about these things? Things today might be acceptable. What you learn in this class, too, might be with the theory of the day. But the beauty about science is what? It changes with evidence. And the more evidence that is accumulated over time, new ideas come about. Old theories might die out. And you continue to add to that based on evidence practice, right? In healthcare, it's all about evidence practice. And they look back at those things and they kind of say, oh, we really screwed up lots of things. Killed people, right? Do no harm, but actually killing people. But they didn't know it at the time. So the point is, think all the time about things and pay attention. Okay, so 10:30. Well, I want to go through a little bit of this. It's kind of fun. Let's see what we can do. So the other day, just to bring this up, if you want to search something, right? You want to look up something. So my son had a friend over at the house, and my mom was there, and she's 91, right? And she's got all the things with 91-year-olds. And I'm still there, you know, being told what to do and not to do. And she's like, "God, mother." But my son's friend was over there, and he's, you know, I got a sore throat, and I think I got strep throat every time I get a strep throat, but I'm just going to kind of wait it out and, you know, see if it goes away. What's a bad problem with that? It doesn't go away very well. Anybody ever have strep throat? Right. It's pretty bad. You've got to get fever and everything else. So my mom, as she is, in a different generation completely, she said, "So what's wrong with these kids today?" Back in her day, you know, think back 91 or 80 years ago, people died with strep throat. Died. Just having strep throat. Now, why would you die with strep throat? And in many countries, many places in the world, people still die from strep throat. Right? So she said, "Are you crazy? You need to go to the doctor and get some antibiotics." "Oh, well, I don't really want to take antibiotics." "Well, okay, you can die young if you want to." Okay. So, what's the problem? And then she said, "Well, you know you can have heart problems with this." She said, "Heart, strep throat, heart problems? Why?" Anybody know why you would have a heart problem with strep throat?
Endocarditis.
Uh-huh. But why does it come about?
Because the bacteria can grow on the
calcium. Kind of. But there's something next to that. It's called rheumatic heart fever. So people would get rheumatic heart fever with rheumatic heart with strep throat. And then your valves dysfunction. But why do your valves dysfunction? So I'm sitting here online with my little Surface, and I show my kids and this other friend that's there, and my son's getting a little education at the time. He says, "Oh God, Dad, you know, this is why we don't come over for dinner." Okay. And so, what do? We look up, and I have this on the site, but I'll just go through it because I'll save time. But it's a good learning lesson for you. Something to think about. When you come up with a question like that, what do you want to do? Just let it file it away? Maybe have a misconception? Keep that there? No. Stop researching. Dive in. Figure it out. So we hit rheumatic heart fever. Then he finds out, oh, this is really wild. You have streptococci. That's all around you. It's on your skin right now, right? It's everywhere around you. But if you get it in you and it actually takes over and your immune system doesn't hit it out. And there's different forms of streptococci as well, right? And microbiology is a great course. And if you don't get a chance to take medical microbiology, you know, try to take that, especially with the lab. If you can't take it here, go over to BCTC. BCTC offers a wonderful medical microbiology course with a lab, too. And you can even take night courses over there. That's what's kind of nice, too. And summer courses. But it's a great course to take. It should be a requirement for all allied health people. But it's not a requirement for med school. But it is for your nursing students, actually, medical microbiology. It should be required for all health professionals. But so why is it that you have a heart problem? Okay. So you got streptococci. What's going to happen when you get a bacterial inside your body? What's going to hit on with your immune system? You're going to develop antibodies, right, to the antigen. And the antigen is on that bacteria. And if you haven't taken immunology or virology, two great elective courses to take here in the UK, the count towards your upper biology electives. So your body starts to build up antibodies. Those antibodies then will attack that streptococcus. The problem is, the antigen on the streptococci is similar to the glycoproteins that are on your heart valves. So now your own body is attacking itself. Your antibodies are now attacking your heart valves. Okay, some instances, well, so what? The antibody binds to my heart valves. Why does that cause a problem? What's the mechanism behind that? What would happen when an antibody attacks a bacteria? Anybody? Why does it kill it out? It can break the bacterial structure, right? It depends what type of antibody and what kind of complementary protein it is, or if it has some other factors that can actually poke holes in the bacteria, and then it kills the bacteria. But what happens if that's a cell on your heart valve? Poking holes in that cell in your heart valve. It's going to kill that cell out, right? So now you actually learn, hey, antibodies kill bacteria by poking holes in it, but if you have a wrong problem, they're going to poke holes in your natural, in your native cells and cause them to lyse, right? And die. Not a good thing. So this is how you can have heart damage or heart valve problems from having streptococci or having strep throat. So what do you want to do? You want to get antibiotics, right? And kill it out. What's the problem today? The antibiotics. They're getting resistance, right? And why are they getting resistance? They evolved, right? And so the bacteria has evolved. The streptococci has evolved. Different strains. And the bacteria, the antibodies aren't hitting it anymore. Big problem. Once these antibiotics don't work anymore, we're in some real deep doo-doo, right? So what kind of antibiotics are given for this? Usually cephalosporins. So my son and his friend says, well, what on earth are all these different antibiotics? So you look up cephalosporin. So we look it up. Guess where it was discovered? Somewhere like in the 1700s, late 1700s, and you know, figure it out in the 1800s. And what did they figure it out? It was from the sewage outlet in some little town in Italy. Someone saw this growth mass on the sewage, you know, poop, right? It was growing on poop. And they isolated it and found out that that kind of slime and stuff that was growing, and bacteria that was growing on this poop, actually could grow on this, and they isolated that they have cephalosporins, the early cephalosporins. It's kind of like Louis Pasteur with his bacteria, you know, the bread mold, right? Keeping the bacteria from growing. So think about it. It came from crack. I mean, it grew from crack, basically, right? And then that's the cephalosporin, so the history of it. So where it came from. But you use today to treat your streptococcus. Isn't that kind of cool when you search something out, you find out the history of it? So what are some of the side effects of having too much of antibiotics? So there's always, and I like the thing down below. Well, if you take too much of it, it actually causes you to, where you can't clot your blood. It actually inhibits an enzyme with vitamin K for blood clotting. Well, then how does vitamin K work with blood clotting? Now you're off on another tangent, right? So what does vitamin K do with blood clotting? How does vitamin K work with blood clotting? And why, if I take too much of this antibiotic, now I'm going to bleed to death? Well, that's not good either, right? Now I've got a heart problem, I'm going to bleed to death. Well, that's why you take a certain regimen, right? And a certain dose, right? And that's why you go in the therapeutic window. So now you can learn about lots of things. This is the idea. When you search something out, keep asking the question, what about that? What about this? Why is an antibiotic toxic? You know, it's good for you, but no, too much of it's bad for you. Some of the antibiotics cause you to lose your hearing, right? Why? What's the mechanism behind it? So now we get through that. Okay, finally, you know, the dinner's getting cold. And so now we're past all that, we're past antibiotics, past that kind of stuff, past where they came from, but learned a lot about this. And my kid's friend is like, God, this is what you learn in college, you know? He said, no, this isn't what you learn in college. This is what you learn on your own. This is what you learn by doing research on your own. This is what you learn by going through things. We just did this in 10 minutes on this surface right here that you have access to. A long time ago, that would have taken weeks to look up information, right? The advantages that you have today are unreal to look up stuff. You don't have to go truck into the library and pull out journals or anything like that. You get PubMed, right? www.pubmed.gov, scientific articles. And then you can research a lot of information. So then we go through infection. All right, so you get an infection in your finger. Why is your finger hot? If you got an infection in your finger and you got bacteria in there and it's red, it's inflamed, why is your finger hot? But maybe your whole body's not hot. Pardon? Bacteria there, right? So why is your finger hot? Why is it red and swelling and hot? You feel it's hot, you know, if you got a cut and got infected. What's the mechanism behind it? What's raising the temperature to kill the bacteria? Does your cells right there figure that out to kill out the bacteria around your fingertip? Think about this. This is just everyday stuff, right? Everyday stuff. Everyday stuff that you take for granted. So why is it that your finger is going to get hot? Right, this isn't an immunology course. This is a physiology course. And I'm trying to show you that everything integrates, right? So why is it that your finger is getting hot? The idea is that maybe it's trying to kill it out, but white blood cells are congregating to that area. Your bacteria is multiplying too. The white blood cells are these cytokines. They then cause these macrophages to come in there. There's multiplication of cells. When you get that, what happens? The multiplication of cells, fight the infection, bacteria is multiplying. What does that take? Energy. And cells divide, and things like that. Where is that energy? What is that energy? Liberating? Heat, right? You exercise your muscles. You feel your arm, you feel your leg. What happens? Heat, right? Cellular level responses raise that temperature, localized. Now you feel that heat. So it's really metabolism at a local level. Eat a high protein meal, right? Go out and get a big old steak if you're not a vegetarian, right? Or a high protein with something else, tofu. And what happens? You feel warm in a few hours from now and you're sweating it out. Because the metabolism going on in your GI tract, right? That's why your temperature rises, metabolism. And why is it rising in there? It's breaking it down from the enzymes, right? It's breaking bonds. When you break a bond, what happens? Heat's liberated. But not only that, bacteria is multiplying in your GI tract. If it wasn't for that bacteria, it'd be bad for you, right? Because what does that bacteria do in your GI tract? We're going to cover GI physiology. But I just want you to think about all these things. What's that bacteria doing in your GI tract? Why is it not good just to keep eating a whole bunch of antibiotics? Because you can kill your own bacteria. In your GI tract, what happens? You sterilize your GI tract, you're going to have diarrhea, but you're also going to end up in the ER, probably. And then what's going to happen? If you don't die from it, the new treatments are to do what? Something really gross. It's a fecal transplant. Yes, it's a fecal transplant. Poop from somebody else. Put up your behind. To do what? To save your life, basically. And so, fecal transplants are real. And so they can actually, and that tells you how important the bacteria in your GI tract is. Because it helps to metabolize. But that bacteria, about 30% of your poop, the next time you take poop, look at it. About 30% of it, don't take it out and weigh it or anything. About 30% of it is actually bacteria that was in your GI tract that helps you metabolize your food. Isn't that something? About 30% of your poop is bacteria that's in your GI tract. I know it's gross. But now think about the importance of that bacteria. What is it doing for you? So we didn't get through the first lecture because this is the way it always is. I'm always behind. Because we have tangents. But these tangents are good. Hopefully what I've done today is what? Showed you some really neat physiology. Told you about the class. Get you to think about things. Mechanisms. Good resources. Things like that. All right?
I finally got accepted into that program or whatnot. And also give me.
No, it's the University of Copenhagen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was the person who talked
about it. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I didn't give names.
You can speak up. But I also finally got accepted.